Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Today we're going to start with a study from the University of Southern Australia. And it's about almonds, something that is not expensive, all natural, and here's what it does. Almonds can enhance weight loss, boost your heart health, despite even their high fat content, but it's a good fat. According to the university, walnuts are often overlooked in weight loss plans due to their high fat content. Australian researchers are challenging this notion, revealing that almonds can actually aid in slimming down. Touted as the largest of its kind study, University of South Australia scientists discovered that when people added almonds to a calorie-restricted diet, not only did they lose weight, but their overall heart health improved as well. And that's a big deal. People in the study lost an average of 15 pounds, but also had better heart-related outcomes. Here's what they say, quote, both the nut and nut-free diets resulted in approximately 9.3% reduction in body weight over the trial. Yet the almond-supplemented diets also demonstrated statistically significant changes in some highly atherogenic lipoprotein subfractions, which may lead to improved cardiometabolic health in the longer term. In lay language, that just means that you're going to have a healthier heart, and we all want healthier hearts. From Capital Medical University in China, an article published in the peer-reviewed journal Frontiers in Pharmacology, compounds in green tea can prevent liver cancer cells from spreading. Liver cancer is a serious cancer. Now, most cancers don't start in the liver. They might start in the pancreas and then metastasize to the liver. And that's always bad. And why? Because the liver does two primary things, does a lot of other things, but it metabolizes all the nutrients. Let's say that you take a vitamin. You take vitamin B6 or vitamin C. The body can't utilize vitamin B6 or vitamin C, ascorbic acid, per se. It has to be converted into ascorbate or into pyridoxal 5-phosphate, and then the body can use it. It does this metabolizing with every meal. So a healthy liver means healthier metabolism, and that in turn means better nutrients getting to your cells and a greater chance of having those nutrients fully absorbed. So you want a healthy diet for healthy metabolism, utilization, and elimination, and all that the liver is responsible for. Then the liver does something else. The liver is your really important detoxification organ, along with the kidneys. So when you have toxins in the body, the liver helps take care of those toxins, conjugates them, and gets them out. And that's a big deal, because when people don't have kidney function, they're not hydrated enough, they have too much sodium, they don't have enough calcium, they don't have enough magnesium, all the different things that the kidney needs in balance, well then, it doesn't work. And that's not good. So also, the more high fructose corn syrup, the more sweetener, mainly from soft drinks, that you take into your diet, the worse your liver becomes. That also stresses the kidney. You can end up with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It means your liver is not healthy. It has fat in it. And that disrupts all these metabolic activities. So a healthy liver comes from a healthy, clean diet. Lots of chlorophyll. Seaweed, the brown seaweed's good for the liver. Chlorella, spirulina, barley grass juice, wheatgrass juice. Those are your five big, great nutrients to clean your liver and keep it healthy. But also, the most important nutrient coming out of that liver is glutathione. And if you're not making enough glutathione, then take alpha lipoic acid, 600 milligrams a day, and glutamine each day, about 1,000 milligrams. So when you're taking different nutrients, they combine to stimulate the production of glutathione. So juicing is good, Green juice is especially good for the liver and the kidneys. So we want to make sure that your food is broken down and that it's healthy so that if you have cancer in one part of the body, it doesn't spread to the liver. Because when you start using some of the typical chemotherapies, if the liver is affected, it makes it much more difficult to regain your immune competence. So green tea every day can help prevent liver cancer cells from spreading. And this was published in Frontiers in Pharmacology. Next up, pediatricians group warns kids against the keto, K-E-T-O, diet for children with diabetes. This is from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And what they say that a low-carbohydrate diet may be all the rage, but they're not for kids with diabetes. In a new report, they say that a low-carbohydrate diet cannot be recommended for children or teenagers with either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And we have a lot of teenagers with type 2 diabetes. And by the way, unlike type 1 diabetes, they can be genetic. Type 2 diabetes is something you actually create by sugary drinks, lots of sweets, lots of processed foods that are very low in nutrients and high in calories. And these are not healthy. What you need are vegetables and beans and fiber-rich grains. And then in about somewhere in the neighborhood of about, 20 grams per day, equivalent to about a cup. And the keto diet and similar ones can put very strict limits on carbs. That's way too little. You need far more than a half a cup of white rice every day, and you shouldn't be eating white rice to begin with. So look at what your body needs. There are so many highly qualified nutritionists, dietitians, holistic nurses, and there are people who are health counselors who have a good background. So work with them on this. And finally, from Brigham and Women's Hospital up in Boston, they ask a question. Can pomegranate juice, we're talking about juice, not watered down, not diluted, not sugar infused, just juice, can that protect an infant's brain? So according to them, when it comes to protecting a newborn brain, taking steps to mitigate risk before birth can be critical. Some newborns, such as those with, let's say, intrauterine growth restriction, or what is called IUGR, are at the highest risk. So being able to intervene before birth to aid in protecting the newborn brain may prevent the often devastating effects of brain injury. In ongoing investigations, clinical researchers from Brigham Women's Hospital are exploring whether pomegranate juice intake during pregnancy can have a protective, positive effect. A paper appearing in PLOS One, a major scientific journal, the team presents its preliminary findings from a clinical trial of expectant mothers whose babies were diagnosed with IUGR. And it shows very good promise. With the evidence of better brain development and better brain connectivity in infants born to mothers who consume juice daily. And a second larger trial is currently underway. So right now, thumbs up to the Department of Pediatric Newborn Medicine at Brigham Hospital for doing this study. It's an original study. I commend them on it. And by the way, it's not just pomegranates, but also all berries are good in these nutrients as well. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We have been told repeatedly by all authorities from the CDC and the FDA and everyone involved with the National Institute of Health concerning COVID, it's safe and effective, the vaccine. And even the new variants have vaccines. And yet none of these have been tested in any qualified study on humans. We're just supposed to trust them. Well, remember they said, here's what they said. Well, the spike protein will be created by your cells from the vaccine, but that'll be, quote, here's from them. This is from the CDC. and they said, will be, quote, broken down within a few days after vaccination and doesn't last long in the body. Okay, so you figure maybe a week. All right. That's a position that it is adhered to, and it hasn't changed. They continued, Dr. Lewinsky, all of them say the same thing. But now we find out from a brand new study that the CDC refers to the M, meaning modified RNA. And now they're saying, well, it's really a messenger RNA, whereas regulatory documents and Pfizer refers to the mRNA, a COVID vaccine, is, quote, modified RNA. Why didn't they explain this? Why didn't the Surgeon General or Anthony Fauci have a press conference and then show the actual clinical study results, but they didn't? So here's what we now know. And for all of you pro-vaccine people, and that's fine, I fully support you. But if you run into problems and understand that there are solutions that can help you, and I'm going to be doing a special one-hour broadcast on that in the next 2 weeks. So if you find you have some problems or people you know have problems, at least you have the best medical doctors and scientists in the world who are in my documentary. And I'm going to share it free with the people. And you can write down the information because you may need that in your life, may be saved because of it. If you don't have a problem, fine. But we figure the problems are going to last over the next 10 years. So here's a study that was just published August 31st in Proteomics Clinical Applications. That's a major peer-reviewed journal. And here's exactly what they found. The spike protein in the biological fluids of people who received the mRNA vaccine for COVID-19, it's still there 6 months. Let me repeat this. It's still in the blood 6 months later, after vaccination. Now, what does that mean? That means that that RNA vaccine that you received, it may be integrated or interscribed in some cells. And that's not good. We had a guest on almost a year ago discussing this as a potential because they were finding DNA, which we were told was not in the vaccine, and yet it was real high, 1,000 times higher than what they said was safe, and yet it was in there. Now, this study of these subjects who received 2 doses of the mRNA COVID vaccine, and then they compared it to a group who were not vaccinated and tested negative for COVID, or where antibodies indicated they had previously been infected, so they had natural immunity. And what they found is that they tested to a differentiate synthetic spike protein originating from the mRNA vaccines. And it was found in the blood, the urine, the saliva, and in fact, in the lavage fluids, and this is not good. So the spike protein from RNA differs from the post-infection spike protein. So just saying, there's trouble here, and this is brand new, and we're concerned. I'll keep you posted on this information on upcoming programs. Now, let's go back to empowering you with new information. One of the most respected historians and philosophers in the world is Neil Oliver. He's from Scotland. He's very popular because he speaks the truth. But the new cancel culture, the woke mob, has decided he should not be in an honored position as a member of the Royal Fellow. That's a very prestigious position. That even dwarfs the Nobel Prize. So, but they asked him to leave. He resigned. Here's what he had to say.
Indeed, and Neil, speaking of cancel culture, it's come pretty close to you now. You have resigned as a fellow from Scotland's most prestigious scientific body, the Royal Society of Edinburgh, after being elected in 2020 for your talents across history and nature and archaeology, which are unmatched. But a spokesman for the society said in discussion with Mr. Oliver, he understood that his current views on various matters widely aired on television put him at odds with scientific and broader academic learning within the society. Following discussions, he offered to resign his association with the RSE with immediate effect. So, Neil, this has made mainstream media headlines over the past week. You haven't spoken about it. Have you been cancelled for wrong think here?
I mean, clearly there's a considerable chasm between, you know, what's happening to Russell Brand and, you know anything that's happened to me. However, yeah, I mean, just to give a bit of backstory to it, I don't even know how many years ago it was, but I suppose 4 or 5, I think, would be a reasonable estimate. I was contacted by the Royal Society of Edinburgh to see if I would like to become a fellow of the society. And it seemed quite nice. I wasn't particularly bothered one way or the other, but I went along with it and I became a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Because I'm a very busy man, Dan, I'm sure you are, many others are, I didn't have anything to do with it. Actually, I was never over the door of the establishment. I didn't actually take part in anything. I thought no more about it. I didn't even tell anyone that I was a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, apart from my wife and my mum and dad. You know, anyway, so fast forward to just a few months ago, a couple of months ago, I was on holiday with my family in Crete. I was contacted by the Royal Society of Edinburgh, someone saying, we think that your views as aired on GB News are incompatible with fellowship. And I thought, wow, really? Because the Royal Society of Edinburgh, as I understood it, was an august scientific non-partisan body that invited all sorts of opinions and all sorts of points of view. And yet here I was being told that I wasn't keeping to some sort of script that nobody had told me about. I dropped it right then. With no hesitation, there was no consult. As soon as they told me that that was the state of affairs, I dropped it. I said, I'm out. Because, to be quite honest with you, I don't want to be associated with any group that tries to tell its membership what to say and what to think. Because as far as I'm concerned, any group that tries to tell its membership what to say and what to think is a cult. And bad for my brand. I thought, I don't want to be associated with this. Yeah. This is bad for my image. And so I dropped the Royal Society of Edinburgh without a backward glance. And it happened within minutes of me being informed that they thought that my thoughts were, you know, whatever, incompatible with fellowship. So, yeah, I mean, whatever. If that is the way that kind of organisation operates, then I don't want to be anywhere near it. And I dropped them like a hot potato.
Good on you, Neil, but unfortunately it's indicative of where things are going. And I guess that's why your voice is so important. Well, I know that's why your voice is so important here on GB News. Neil Oliver, thank you so much. We'll speak next.
Bless you, Dan.
Now, so he explained that, okay, I don't want my reputation tainted by a whole group of people who are considered some of the finest minds in the world because of their biases and their lack of intellectual curiosity, their lack of openness to discuss issues. Wow. That's how powerful these people have become. Now, here's one reason that they may have felt, well, you're being too honest, Neil, and we can't handle that. Here's his talk. To be sovereign is to have absolute authority over our own bodies. Is that radical? Is that too extreme? Haven't we been living? Haven't those of us who've been in the women's movement and to the gay movements and into the free yourself from the enslavement of the state and institutional control, haven't we been working so you can have sovereignty, my body, my mind, my control, my choice? I know the people in this audience want to have the choice of what happens to their body. So listen to what he has to say, and then ask yourself, do you think or do you believe that what he says is such a threat that they have to destroy his voice? Let's go to the clip.
She is dead.
the girl who wanted to live in defiance of a rare genetic condition, the girl who fought in the end to live in defiance of NHS doctors and a judge who declared and ruled that she should just lie down and die, is gone now. We were not and are not allowed to know her name. Her grieving family are still barred by the court that condemned their daughter to death from naming her in public. We have been allowed to know her only as ST, which is coincidentally shorthand for saint. Saints are remembered long after they are gone. This is where we are now. A sovereign individual says she wants to live, asks the state to help her stay alive, makes clear her intention to exercise her God-given free will to seek potentially life-saving treatment elsewhere. Two psychiatrists listened to the 19-year-old while she lived and concluded that she was of sound mind and able to make her own decisions regarding her treatment. Other sovereign individuals stood ready to help the girl to finance her proposed trip to Canada for experimental treatment. Despite all that, in sullen defiance of all that, NHS doctors decided her unwillingness to accept her death was inevitable, made her delusional. Everyone's death is inevitable. Are we to accept that each one of us is delusional if we seek to fight death every inch of the way? A judge agreed ST was deluded and the die was cast. Now she is dead, as prescribed by the state. This is where we are now, confronted at every turn by an overmighty, overweening state that has assumed the ultimate power over sovereign individuals. Somewhere along the line, at some point, most of us overlooked, myself included, sovereign Britain was subverted or otherwise replaced by corporate Britain, in which a board of corporate types assumes the authority to make all decisions on our behalf. I say this is unlawful in every way that matters. It's also monstrous and just plain wrong. Too few people know, remember, far less celebrate what it is to be sovereign. We're not taught any of this at school, which is hardly surprising given the recent context. But the truth is that we are born sovereign, and to be sovereign is to have absolute authority over our own bodies. We are subject to the common law of the land, which we break only when we harm others, damage their property, steal what is not ours, or behave fraudulently in our dealings with others. Every other attempt by the state to interfere with our freedom to go about our lives unmolested is the stuff of statute, which is the legislation, acts and bills drawn up and passed by Parliament. Legislation has power over us only if we consent to it. Rules and regulations defined by statute are said in dictionaries of law to acquire the force of law only when we grant our consent. A fact of being sovereign is that if we withhold or withdraw our consent, that is the end of the matter. And deep down where the state and all its little wizards would prefer we did not look, the state knows this too. Over and over again, it has been necessary to pull the state up by the scruff of its scrawny neck and remind it of the limits of its power, and to have it acknowledge instead the supreme power of the sovereign individual. Magna Carta was the consequence of one of those times when an overmighty king had to be reminded that, like everyone else, he was subject to the law of the land. King John wriggled on that hook, but it was swallowed deep. Parliament would prefer Magna Carta did not exist, but it does exist and always will, and it burns the state like holy water thrown in a demon's face. If the state could destroy Magna Carta, unmake it, then it surely would. The state seeks to dismiss it, to paper over it, to distract us and have us look the other way, to persuade us the Great Charter's power is gone long ago like that of a battery run flat. But deep down, the state knows the law of the land still thrums with power over them. The fact, the inconvenient truth, is that the law of the land is older than Parliament. Magna Carta, which only restated and reaffirmed the ancient common law, was sealed before Parliament even existed, and so is literally beyond Parliament's remit. The unwritten constitution for which Magna Carta speaks is likewise out of Parliament's reach. The law of the land just is. We all know without having to be told that it's wrong to kill, to do harm, to steal, to lie. Parliament, government, the state are no more and no less than creations of human beings. That which is created by human beings stands beneath human beings, is subordinate to human beings, serves and does not rule human beings. Remember that too when talk turns to artificial intelligence. Nefarious types in the state know the inalienable rights of people are constant as the North Star. Many of the state's minions may have chosen to forget as much. Plenty of Parliament's wizards are, like so many other people, genuinely unaware of the truth of the law. Lack of knowing is of no significance. The truth is the truth, whether it's known or not. Magna Carta was the restating of truth, restating of the common law that by the time of the sealing of that charter was old beyond the reach of memory. The Nuremberg Code, born in the dark shadow of World War II and all its attendant horrors, was another time when some people had to be reminded of that which is true, which is that the individual, every individual, is sovereign, having absolute authority over his or her flesh and blood, and that nothing, nothing at all, might be done to a sovereign individual against their will without their consent. The code is primarily for the attention of physicians, and point number one states, quote, "The voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. This means that the person involved should have legal capacity to give consent, should be so situated as to be able to exercise free power of choice without the intervention of any element of force, fraud, deceit, duress, overreaching, or other ulterior form of constraint or coercion." The Nuremberg Code is not binding in a legal sense, but which decent human being would dispute the thinking and intent at the heart of its matter? How much of the Nuremberg Code was ignored during the COVID debacle? How much is still being ignored while I speak these words? There is much debate over whether or not the state uses what are called legal fictions to gull us into submitting to its legislation. There are those who argue that our birth certificates and the registering of our births are part of a legal process, legal and not lawful, by which a corporation is created in each of our names as it appears on our birth certificate, and then by the process of the registering of the birth, that corporation is handed off to the state to do with as it pleases. That legal fiction has been described as being like an overcoat tailored by the state and offered to each of us for wearing. If we don the coat, the thinking goes, we unwittingly accept the rules of the game the state is playing. Be that as it may, entertain the speculation about legal fictions and straw men, or don't. But the fact remains that the power of the state, a creation of man, over any of us is only that which any of us consents to give. And yet the 19-year-old girl ST is dead now, without her consent, despite her spoken determination to fight for life. This is where we are now, and this is why I ask whether it's time for the call for change that is described by some as revolution. Last week, I put a couple of lines on social media, wondering if anyone else was thinking about revolution. Last time I checked, each of the messages had been viewed over a million times. I've been contacted by people from all over the West, saying their thoughts chime with mine. I hear especially from Americans looking on in desperation while their country floods from the South with millions of newcomers of unknown provenance and intent. I live in a world of unanswered questions. I want to know the truth of the products pushed as vaccines. I want to know how many people were killed or hurt by those products. I want to know why hundreds more people are dying every day in this country than might have been estimated based on previous years. That's the equivalent of an unexplained passenger plane crash every day. Why are those people dying? I want to know what happened in the care homes into which vulnerable elderly people were herded from their hospital beds. So many died, many alone and in circumstances of abject misery. I want to know exactly how those elders died. I know that many of their loved ones want to know those details too. Yet again, we have plainly reached a point when the state must be reminded who's in charge, which is to say, we are in charge, the sovereign individuals of this land. This is where we are now in the West. The state is making no secret of the further powers it would award itself, fantasising about kicking down our doors and stamping on our lives.
But we are sovereign people in sovereign nations, watching the day-by-day reality of a corporate takeover of our very existence. Authority over our lives, our way of life, unlawfully assumed by corporations. Corporation, there's another word worth paying attention to. It means to make or fashion into a body, a whole composed of united parts. If a corporation isn't a Frankenstein's monster, that unhappiest of creations and capable of inflicting terrible harm upon those it has come to despise, then I don't know what is. Here's the thing. I have no interest in pitchforks and flaming torches. The killing of people and the destruction of property and infrastructure are the activities of government and the state, and I want no part of that. What I do want is to talk about the need and desire for change felt by millions, many millions. I say every politician who pushed lockdowns, mandates and experimental medical procedures, not to mention the net zero suicide note, might usefully be walked out of the Palace of Westminster and sent home. We're past the time when reform was possible. It's time now for something new, something clean. Is it just me? Or is there something in the wind?
And that's Neil Oliver. Now we're continuing with part 5 of our series on wokeism and cancel culture, and with it identity politics and the white fragility movement. They have infiltrated every segment of society, from the judiciary to the legislative branches of government, making laws that impact all of us. Well, this is the new religion of wokeness. And what we're doing is we're not bringing people on who are the screamers, the demeaners, the deniers, the physically violent ones who want to kill one of the leading feminist lesbian voices in Great Britain, who told us on, you heard her last week on Progressive Commentary Hour, say that she and her lesbian friends can no longer go to a pride meet because there are people there who want to kill her, want to beat her. Wow. How did that happen? And yet it has. So let's listen to their religion of wokeness.
Adherence to traditional religion is in decline. Something new is taking its place, and I'm deeply concerned about what the results might be.
We will!
We are!
We are!
Everybody give your motherfucking me!
I will love my black neighbors the same as my white ones.
I will love my black neighbors.
You may lose God from your society, and as a non-believer, I have very mixed views about that. But just because you've lost God from your society doesn't mean you don't have God-shaped holes. The massive God-shaped hole in our society is what the hell people are meant to be doing with their time here on Earth. The woke answer it with a pretty good answer of their own, which is that life can be most meaningfully lived by fighting for justice.
The never-ending fight for justice has become a new political religion that is based largely around the concept of intersectionality. Intersectionality is the idea that people can have more than one overlapping marginalized identity characteristic. Whoever has the most marginalized characteristics is the most oppressed and has the best access to truth. As a result of prizing subjective experience over objective truth, it is nearly impossible to have productive conversations on important issues, and many otherwise intelligent people have started to believe and act in ways that they otherwise would not.
It's not just that it's just spontaneously or arbitrarily pops up. There's a system in place that manufactures these ideas. They look at the universities as their own particular ideology mill, and they indoctrinate people into intersectionality. These are people who are teaching very dangerous ideas. What makes those ideas dangerous is that they're divisive. We start looking at each other in terms of race. This does not advance civil rights causes. It's exactly the opposite. One of the reasons this has taken such sway is because there's a kernel of truth to all of it.
As a result of the tragic killing of George Floyd and others, books like White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist have once again become bestsellers as people try to make sense of race in America and figure out what they can do to help. The problem is that these books are acting as poorly written religious tracts that convey concepts like all white people are racist and literally everything in life revolves around race. Masses of people are being indoctrinated into a new religion without even realizing it. It probably doesn't feel like indoctrination. Many people may just think that we are finally waking up to injustice. The truth, however, is much more dismal. The iconic texts of the woke religion are intentionally divisive, and the end goal is not equality. Objectivity, reason, and even science itself are considered to be white, male, Western constructs, rather than simply being the best tools we have to understand reality. This kind of thinking is being pushed on people of all ages.
We now even hear of children being told that if their parents or grandparents do not agree with the views that they have been given, then they should distance themselves or condemn their parents and grandparents. And I think, by the way, that this is revealing of nothing so much as a cult. Any movement that says that people you love who do not entirely agree with the point of view that you are told to believe, that you should distance yourself from those people, that's a cult. It's a cult.
One key aspect of successful indoctrination is not being aware that it's occurring. It took me a while to realize it, but I know what it's like to be indoctrinated and to have my view of reality drastically altered by religion. I grew up in a small conservative town where nearly every aspect of my life was controlled. I was brought up in a fundamentalist sect of Christianity and was sheltered from much of the outside world. Any secular influence had the potential to lead me into sin, so it had to be kept away. Similarly, the woke are creating an environment in which speech and actions need to be controlled or silenced. Anything that doesn't conform to this puritanical worldview is simply wrong. There are goals to be reached, and the ends certainly justify the means. Workplaces and schools are being segregated for special diversity trainings. Desperately needed police units are being defunded, and people are taught that their skin color is something to obsess over rather than ignore. But this is all done in the name of justice, and it's seen as virtuous.
Why do you think people are so hoodwinked by this?
Because it's an answer to a number of very big questions. It says in a quasi-religious manner, in fact, it's better than religion, isn't it? Because religion says if you sort these things out, then in a life to come, you will find salvation. And the social justice activists and the intersectionists and much more say, if you do all of these things, we can get justice here on earth.
So one of the reasons I think people are so hoodwinked, I think they're hoodwinked by language. Mm. I think they're hoodwinked by these words. Equity sounds really good. Mm. Inclusion sounds really good. Diversity sounds really good. Safe space sounds really good. All of these words sound good. And most people, they don't really know what they mean. I mean, just think. Anti-racism.
Mm. Yeah, who's not on board with that?
If you don't know the moral underpinnings of that, or Black Lives Matter, well, of course Black Lives Matter.
Mm. Yeah. Once people agree on the reprehensible nature of racism, homophobia, bigotry, misogyny, once they agree on that, then of course they want to be on the side of the people opposed to all of that. The problem is then you jump onto the side of all the people who are opposed to all that, and you discover they can do things as wicked as anyone else.
Right.
The woke social justice movement has managed to institutionalize a new set of beliefs and even their own language in virtually every aspect of our society. Many people latch onto these beliefs because they find a community of others doing the same. One of the more positive aspects of growing up in a Christian home was having a sense of belonging and community. Not only that, but my Christian faith gave me a purpose, a grand narrative that inspired and motivated me. Having a sense of purpose and meaning allows us to endure the hardships and tragedies we face in life. Given the decline of traditional religion, there needs to be something else that gives people a narrative and provides purpose and meaning. Fighting for so-called justice and equality is what provides that for huge swaths of people today. Many of these people believe they are on the front lines of a new civil rights movement, even though most of those battles have already been won, and it has never been better in America than the present day.
When you say never been better, some people think you mean, oh, absolutely everything's sorted out, is it? I don't say that. But I say it's very obvious, provable, by any fair estimation, that the situation in America today on every rights issue is nothing like the situation it was in the 1950s and 60s. We've come a long way very fast, and people should be very proud of it. But there are people, as I say, who believe that they need to keep struggling. They find meaning in the struggle. They find a purpose in the struggle. And for that struggle to really be engaged in, they need to pretend that our society is institutionally racist, institutionally homophobic, institutionally sexist, misogynistic, patriarchal. and that therefore we have to fight as previous generations did.
She's a fucking Nazi!
The fact that women have long been shut out of dangerous industrial jobs is part of patriarchy.
Rape culture is not a myth! Rape culture is not a myth!
In my late teen years, my faith and entire worldview was starting to collapse. I couldn't help but question the morality of the Bible, and I started to doubt whether God was really full of love if he would be willing to send someone to eternal damnation for simply lacking a belief. My struggle with severe depression peaked at 20 years old, which is when I fully lost my faith. I had nothing left to guide me and nowhere to turn. Without a sense of meaning or any reason to go on, I wanted nothing more than to end my own life. My faith was my entire identity, and I lost it all. There are many things that helped me through that time, including my relationship with my sister, therapy, and medication. But having the opportunity to rebuild my identity, create my own sense of meaning, and finding a community were the crucial and sustainable ways that I overcame my depression.
Many people, when they lose faith and find no system to completely replace it with, replace faith with a form of nihilism. My own belief is that we have an awful lot of flares along our path to guide us, and that is everything that we have and have inherited, which give us an idea of what we might do with our lives. And that's one of the reasons why the total nihilism of the movement that's going on at the moment is so revealing. If you regard the past, all your predecessors, all of everyone else's predecessors, as merely reprehensible, morally imperfect people who didn't have precisely the views we have in 2020, then no wonder that you're staggering around a beleaguered wasteland wondering what the hell you should do with your life, because you haven't listened to anyone, because you're so presumptuous that you think that all of the obvious answers would have been dropped on you like rain. And I have very little sympathy. I have sympathy, but not much tolerance, you might say, for people who say, I don't know what I'm doing here, and have simultaneously snuffed out every single flare along the path that might have guided them.
We need to know our history and how we got to where we are in order to not repeat the mistakes of the past. We already have the tools we need to build meaningful lives. There are certainly injustices out there that are worth fighting for, but this doesn't mean we should blindly accept a new religious calling, especially when it does not encourage forgiveness and redemption, comes with beliefs that are anti-scientific, discourages open inquiry, and has already led to so much harm. What we need is a vision of unity, compassion, and forgiveness. Those of us who are concerned about racism, sexism, and any other form of bigotry need to push back against this discordant and reckless ideology because it achieves the opposite of what it claims.
I was involved with Palestinian Solidarity for 7 years after the death of Rachel Corrie in the Gaza Strip in 2003. Her parents formed the Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice in her memory. A goal of the foundation was cultural exchange. And to that end, in 2010, it was decided to produce a mural in downtown Olympia in collaboration with artists in Palestine. The project found itself enveloped in drama when the Corrie Foundation was accused of racism. Their crimes, tokenization, microaggressions, and cultural appropriation. After endless hours of painful internal meetings, a community forum was held. It was filmed for the public. We were berated by our accusers for our skin color, our privilege, and our ability to be ignorant of the pain we caused them. Any response other than listening was seen as further proof of our racism. We took it seriously. The project was completed, but many people left the foundation and the movement.
I get phone calls now, and they play up the diversity. Oh, we're looking for a diverse set. You know, we want to make sure that we have equal representation on the crew. Okay, fine. I don't care about that. Call me because you think I'm a good DP. Call me because you like the way that I shoot. You like my approach to the job. Essentially, what they're telling me is that they don't consider me to be on the same level of professionalism or ability as Joe Smith. And I feel I've been robbed of something as a result. It's hard not to take it personally.
So the retreat, the first day of the retreat came, and there were two hired professional facilitators who presumably have authority in this area. They were from a local consultancy firm. We went around the room and the facilitators asked us to tell us about your race in the context of your childhood, your adolescence, and your college years. And it got to me and I said, I'm uncomfortable talking about this stuff at work, so I'm gonna pass. So everything seemed like fine after that, but then a few hours later, one of the facilitators said, I want to be clear. Any white person who expresses discomfort or distress or any kind of resistance toward talking about their race when asked to is not actually experiencing discomfort. So don't feel like you should comfort them, because it's not discomfort. It's called white fragility. And it's a power play. This was a public humiliation because I'm white and because I expressed an authentic feeling. This was framed as a manipulative maneuver on my part. It was an act of aggression.
We're going to take a break. And my newest article on this topic, which has gotten a lot of good, input, people found it motivating. Is posted on GaryNull.com. And before we go to GaryNull.com, let me explain that the article is entitled The Social Terrorism of the Intellectual Killing Fields. Where are the wise men and women in every institution coming forward and saying, enough, enough? In one of these people saying, one of the groomers, and telling kids, don't tell your parents, trust me, not your parents. And then school teachers telling kids that the family is a bad construct, and that don't use the word mother, father, brother, sister, because those are not good words. Just use they and them. And then they say this, don't believe in religion. It's all superstition. Okay, we have atheists, we have agnostics, like Dr. Dawkins and others, and they argue their point, and they can make some good arguments, and they should be arguing if that's what they believe, but so too should those people who believe that faith is very important. But here's a question for all of you who believe that wokeism and identity politics is really good. You haven't heard from the voices that have been silent. Those are people of faith. So when you say there is no God, okay, then why don't you read the Old Testament? Why don't you ask all the Jewish scholars, Islamic scholars, Protestant scholars, Buddhist scholars, Jain scholars, Hindu scholars, is all this a myth? And then tell them, we, this small group of radicalists, we believe that we should eliminate the word God. And we should ban Bibles, the Talmud, the Torah, the New Testament, the Old Testament, the Quran. They should all be banished because they're all based upon myth. Let's see how that goes over. Because then you're going to get a pushback. You didn't anticipate, but then again, you don't expect pushbacks because you're in control. You control the media. You control the New York Times, Washington Post, their editorials. You control legislation. Look at California. Right now, you're the mighty terror. Read my article. I'm pushing back. I've done over 40 articles challenging them, not yelling and screaming and demeaning, but methodically deconstructing the vacuity of their arguments, the lack of any sense of reason and historical and scientific perspective. They're just coming through and bludgeoning people into submission. But when you take on all the religions of the world, well, they're going to be less tolerant. Now, we're going to take a break. We'll come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Over the next month, on a daily basis, I will be presenting to you information based upon testimony under oath in Congress on issues that you only hear what the media tells you is important, but not hear the actual discussions. Some of these will really inflame your curiosity because you didn't know this. You didn't know what someone said under oath versus what they're quoted as saying in a press conference. And all of this impacts us on many different levels because I'm taking on a lot of different issues. Also, I will continue tomorrow with a longer segment and then close it out on wokeism. But just to give you an idea, I'm just going to read my first paragraph of my newest article. I've done over 40, as I mentioned. When I see an injustice, I don't hate someone. I don't demean them. I don't castigate them. I simply first go to neutral and try to understand what they're saying, why they're saying it, the context and content. And then I respond. And I have. I've written articles on critical race theory, showing us the new racism, on the anti-fascist movement, who are the new fascists, on freedom of speech, and those who propose that they believe in freedom of speech are the ones who are banning all speech and written materials and even ideas. So read the articles. They're free. They're on GaryNall.com. This one, as I mentioned, is called The Social Terrorism of the Intellectual Killing Fields. Quote, the balkanization of the United States by warring ideological divisions has expended all of their energies that could have been constructively used to bring unity, harmony, and solutions to our crisis and problems. Instead, we face numerous crises, including public health, education, destruction of the environment, food insecurity, homelessness, hunger in children, etc. Instead, the nation's deficit of clear attention has been focused on social sundries, as if the preservation of Western civilization and humanity itself were dependent upon racial, ethnic, and gender identities. For example, the very idea that every single white ever born was born a racist, a terrible person, a person incapable of fitting into society, and forever feel shame because they had some advantage. Really? For example, the very idea that everyone is born as a Caucasian is no longer even psychologically capable of understanding their own racist notion. And that is the message that has been perpetrated, and the media, without critical or intellectual acumen, has accepted it, promoted it. The Second World War should have taught everyone on the planet that the right to determine genetic superiority or inferiority, but it didn't. So did we lose 7 million Jews and Gypsies and Communists and others? Did we lose all the people who fought, the civilians? Did we have one mass genocide for no message? No. No, you do not have the right to determine a person's character based upon solely looking at their skin. You are a fool and a dangerous one, unfortunately. But you're the last person to recognize that because that's become your sole purpose for living and your sole identity of everyone else. Well, that's how far down we have sunk. These are mental constructs used solely for political, social, and ideological ends. The new rules are being written by small groups of extreme radical race hustlers who are determined to define the standards for national identity, individual purpose, and policy based upon their notions of right. And it seems that they are thus far succeeding. This is a lethal game of intellectual debauchery and decadency bereft of any legitimate morality, end quote. That's just the first paragraph. So we need at some point to find the courage to stand up against the mob and to say, sit and talk with civility, and I will listen with understanding. But do not bludgeon me or ask me to kiss your boot and assume that you are, by all measures, right on all things. You are not. We're out of time for WBAI. You have to go to the news. We'll continue to top of the hour on PRN.live. I have a lot more commentaries I'm writing. I'll be sharing them and some special investigative reports over the next week. However, I haven't been offering a premium because we've been so darn busy, so I want to offer one. Now, this is a really good one. I didn't come up with this, but I want to thank Phil and the people in the office for doing this. We're into autumn now. In fact, the East Coast supposed to get some cold and rainy weather. Well, a lot of people end up with stiff joints, sore joints, swollen joints, problems. Now, of course, we know the underlying cause is inflammation. So you've got to change what's causing inflammation. So dietary change is important. Get yourself tested to see, are you nutrient deficient? Because most often the time, my experience is they are. So I've come together with this package. Here it is. The first thing is immune stuff. The second is glucosamine. The third is the award-winning documentary, Reverse Arthritis and Pain Naturally. So who doesn't want to know more about pain relief and helping specifically with conditions using some of the finest board-certified physicians who have input on this? So what is in the product? In immune stuff, which took me several years to create, here's what you're getting: astragalus, vitamin C, orange juice, L-lysine, acerola, amla, citrus bioflavonoids, turmeric, green tea, olive leaf extract, echinacea, mushroom blend of maitake, reishi, cordyceps, sinensis, turkey, tail. You get all these, and lion's mane, zulin, chaga, and more, plus quercetin. And that's quercetin dehydrate extract, so it's very bioavailable. Greens, grapeseed extract, rutin, Bacillus subtilis, a probiotic, zinc, piperine, selenium, and a delicious ginger lemon flavor. And you're also getting vitamin D in this as well. So, who wouldn't benefit from immune stuff to complement your diet and your concern about having as good a system of input as possible? But you're also getting glucosamine that gives you ascorbyl palmitate, magnesium aspartate, MSM, chondroitin sulfate, glucosamine sulfate, N-acetyl glucosamine, sea cucumber, turmeric powder, boswellian, what's called Boswellia serrata, citrus bioflavonoids, oregano, white willow bark powder, broccoli stem powder, garlic clove powder, rosemary leaf powder, and ginger root, all that. So you're getting two things. I don't tell you what it'll do, but you have enough common sense and you can simply Google and see what all these do and what does it show is possible. So those are two, plus you get the documentary about arthritis and pain, helping to reverse those naturally. And you're getting the best information from some of the best physicians and healing people out there, Dr. James Dillard and Dr. Jill Barron, Dr. Norman Marcus, Dr. Daniel Nuchevich, etc. So that's the package, and you can get it with a big discount. How much of a discount? 50%. So you're having a good savings to get something that's really good, healthy, and just call the number. If you want something specifically because you care about your health. All right? Call this number, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Or you can go online. It's on Gary Noll. It's posted there now. And you can call Neil in the Vitamin Closet at 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. Monday to Saturday, noon to 8. You can also go down 35 West 35th Street, 12th floor, and you can visit with him. And he's very good at what he does. Spends a lot of time helping people. That's our show for today. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.